who are looking at the screen this morning and saying, Jeff's just upset because he lost an hour of sleep last night. And we're at the first service this morning. And blessed are those who set their clocks forward and showed up at 9 anyways. Well done. Good to see you this morning. Glad that you are here. I do want to talk about death a little bit this morning. Death, because the truth of the matter is that's one of the most fundamental things about life. Our deaths, our fear of death, the suffering or pain that leads to it. I mean, that's what some people fear about death. It's not the thing itself. It's what you have to go through to get there. We think about death sometimes because of how it affects the people we love. We worry about death maybe not so much for our own sake, but we're worried about those we leave behind, a spouse, a children perhaps. Or maybe we worry about death more because we don't want to be the one left behind. I know sometimes spouses, as they get older, they worry about the death of their beloved and the loneliness that will remain for them. Sometimes we think about death because, frankly, we just wonder what happens, what really happens when we die. I've known people over the years who wrestle with that, not so much even for themselves, but when a loved one has died or is on death's doorstep, and they want to know what's going to happen to their loved one. What happens? Do they see angels? Do they see a light? Where do they go? What's the intermediate state all about? What happens between when we die and when Jesus comes back in Judgment Day and all of that? You see, every death creates a web of effects that go beyond just the person who has died and affect everybody in their life in some way. And of course, there are all sorts of scary ways to die. There could be the plane crash, which is why some of us don't like to fly. There could be the sudden heart attack. There could be a shark attack, which is why some of us don't like the beach. But the truth of the matter is there is a sense in which the Bible is really a book consumed by the subject of death when you stop and think about it. I mean, after all, isn't the Bible really a book about death came into the world and what God's going to do to overcome death? Can't that in one sense be the Bible's summary in a nutshell? You're going to die, but here's what God's going to do about it? That's really what it all comes down to, isn't it? That's literally what happens in the Bible. And the fact, Frank, I think, you know, after the past 12 months, I think part of what's made the past 12 months so hard for so many of us, aside from many other obstacles and challenges and setbacks perhaps that the past 12 months have brought, is the simple fact that for the past 12 months, we have been looking death in the eye in a way that is new and unfamiliar for many of us. Death has forced its way back onto the radar in a way that makes us uncomfortable. But again, the fact of the matter is the Bible is a book consumed by it. Death enters the Bible in Genesis chapter 3 and literally isn't done away with till Revelation chapter 20. When finally at the end of the book in verse 14 of Revelation 20, John says, I saw that death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. Death itself goes to hell in the last day, folks. Death itself is cast into the lake of fire. It is finally done away with. It is removed. I want to talk with you about death for the few minutes that I have with you this morning. Going all the way back to the beginning, as I've already mentioned, in Genesis chapter 3, beginning in verse 17, God says to Adam after he'd eaten of the forbidden fruit, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and you have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying you shall not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you, and toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you, and you will eat the plants of the field by the sweat of your face. You will eat that bread until you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. And so that's where it comes from. We were taken from the ground. You remember back in Genesis chapter 2, God formed the man out of the dust of the ground, breathed into the man's nostrils the breath of life, God's own spirit, as it were, giving us life, something unique from all the other animals who live. God literally, in a sense, is the spark that starts the fire that is the human soul and the human life. And so we were made for something different. We were made for something far better. We were made to be fruitful and multiply. We were made to have dominion. We were made to keep and attend and guard and protect the garden. We were not made to die, but we ate of that forbidden fruit, and then we are left with the stunning image that all of us are familiar with, because all of us have been to enough funerals over the course of our lives. From dust you were taken, and to dust you shall return. God says, because you have disobeyed me, I will send you back to where you have come. Without me, you are nothing. Without my spirit, without my breath, you are but dust. And without that, without me, you will return to that dust. Let that sink in this morning. Let that humble you. Let that sober you. Each and every one of us, we are without God nothing but dust. We are mud that lives because of God's gift of life. And without him, we are just dust of the ground. Reminds me of a story of a little boy who, after church, had been listening intently to the sermon. As soon as the sermon was over, as soon as the service was over, tells his parents he's got to go talk to the preacher. And he goes running up to the preacher after service, and he says, "Preacher, I heard you say today that our bodies are from dust. And when we die, our bodies go back to the dust." And the preacher was really pleased that a little child was actually paying attention during the long sermon. And he said, that's right, little boy. That's right, Johnny. That's what happens. That's where we come from, and that's where we go. But why are you so interested in that?" And the little boy said, "Well, you better come over to my house right away and look under my bed, because somebody's either coming or going. I'm not sure which." Dust. That's all we are. You do realize, not to be too gross this morning, that we literally shed the dust that sits all over our homes. Next time you're cleaning house, remember the reminder of your mortality. Dust we are, and dust we return. And so we lose our lives, we lose our dominion, we lose our provision, we die, we return to the dust. God takes away access to the tree of life to put us in our place, to remind us that without him we are nothing. But also because in God's love, he cannot allow us to live forever in the broken state that we now are because of sin. We were created to walk with God with no sin, no shame, no guilt. We have sinned, and now come the consequences. And to my mind, there's no more poignant story in all of the Bible that brings the ugliness of death to a head than when Jesus himself, God made flesh and dwelling among us, when God himself walks to the grave of his beloved friend Lazarus in John chapter 11. You remember the story. Jesus' close friends are Mary and Martha and their brother Lazarus. And Lazarus gets sick and Lazarus dies. And Jesus goes to the tomb and Mary falls to his feet saying, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And when Jesus therefore saw her weeping, the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit. He was troubled and he said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said, "Lord, come and see." And every child's favorite memory verse, but honestly no more poignant verse in all the Bible than John 11, verse 35. And when Jesus went to the tomb of Lazarus, he wept. He wept. And so the Jews were saying, "See how he loved him." But some said, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man Lazarus also from dying?" Here's a family Jesus knew well. And Jesus goes to the grave of his friend and he weeps. The Jews know his love. Those are tears of loss. Those are tears of compassion. Those are tears of love. And the fact of the matter is, folks, even though Jesus, and John 11 makes very clear that Jesus has gone to the tomb, Jesus has gone to Bethany with the intention of raising Lazarus. He knows that he's going to work another sign to the world of who he is and the power that he possesses, that he is God. And he has power even over death. Even though he knows what he is about to do, he still cries. Why? Why, if he knows in just a few minutes he's going to speak the words, "Lazarus, come forth," and a man who is 4 days dead and stinks with decay already is going to quit being a corpse and become a human being once again who stumbles out in his grave clothes and is unwrapped and set free? Why would Jesus still weep in that moment? Because even as God and his humanity sees firsthand and experiences firsthand what death does to us, even the one who has the power to overcome death, to speak it away, still has his heart broken. When he saw their sorrow, John says, sees them weeping, and he weeps with them. Even when you know how the story ends, even when you know what's going to be done, even when you know there's a better place out there for the people of God, there's still something unnatural, unholy about death. We just know this in our bones. We were created to live and not die. And so we wrestle with that. Because even though as Christians, and this is important to understand because Jesus sets an example for us here in John 11, even though we as Christians as well know there's another chapter to the story, death is not the end, especially for those who know God through Jesus. It's still unnatural. And so there's a difference of being afraid of death and being uncomfortable with death. I think sometimes Christians slide too easily into happy talk in the face of death and in the face of the funeral, and we want to sit there and think that Christians don't cry or there's nothing to be fearful of. Listen, death is unnatural, and it's not good. And it's still in 1 Corinthians 15 called an enemy, even this side of the cross, because God does not will it so for his people. It's the consequence of sin. This is not what God wants. This is not why God made us. There's certainly a difference in being paralyzed by the fear of death, which is what we cannot be, and being made uncomfortable with it, which we ought to be because it's not natural. It's something that God sees very much as an enemy and intends to deal with. And so we live in a fallen world. And we're going to watch people we love get old and die, get sick and die. And eventually we are going to get old and we are going to die. And we're going to have to learn to live with that. I think about Matthew chapter 6 for all its familiarity. In Matthew chapter 6, beginning in verse 19, Jesus says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." We live so hard for this world, even though it's always bound to disappoint, even though nothing can ultimately be depended upon, which is part of what Jesus is trying to get us to understand there. Your treasure on earth isn't going to help you. Because the fact of the matter is, when you look at that language, it's either something natural that's going to rob wealth of its seeming power, the moth and the rust that leads to decay, or it's going to be somebody's going to do something to you. It's going to be the thieves that steal it. But either way, wealth fails in the end. We live so hard for this world, even though it's always bound to disappoint. If it's not the injustice of others, the thieves who steal it, it's simply the natural course of things, that things rust and fall apart. You live in the same house long enough, and eventually what do you have to do? You have to put a new roof on. You have to replace the air conditioning. Eventually you have to replumb the silly thing. Because what happens? This is the rule of the world. And so the tighter we hold on to life, the fact of the matter is, the harder it becomes to let it go, because your treasure and your heart are closely linked. That's what Jesus says. And so we need to beware that you can't keep it. You can't keep anything. That's part of what Matthew 6 is really getting at. Whatever your treasure is, maybe it's materialism, but listen, whatever is important in your life, you can't keep it. That's part of what death reminds us of. You can't keep it. You can't keep your youth as much as you want to be. You can't keep your energy and your vitality. You can't keep your health. You can't keep your money. You can't hold on to it. Think about it. 40 or 50 years on, whatever's important to you this morning, whether it's your wealth, your youth, your energy, your family, whatever it is, 40 or 50 years from now, you realize it's all going to be completely out of your control. It's going to be in somebody else's hands, somebody else's control 40 or 50 years from now. That's how it works. And so the more we try to make this world heaven by holding on to things, the more frustrated we will be. Another familiar passage that talks about this, in James chapter 4, subtle ways, little windows on the death. I told you the Bible's a book actually consumed by death. James chapter 4, verses 13 beginning, James says, "Now come now, you who say today or tomorrow we're going to go to such and such a city, we're going to spend a year there, engage in business, make a profit, yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor, a cloud, a mist, steam that appears for a little while and vanishes away. Instead, what you ought to be saying is, if the Lord wills, we'll live and do this or that." Which, by the way, in our common recollection of this passage, as familiar as it is, that's the part of the line we often skip. We often go from, "if the Lord wills, we'll do this or that." But look at what James actually says first. If the Lord wills what? We will even live. As it is, what you're really doing is boasting in arrogance, James says. That kind of boasting's evil. We plan as though we're going to be here forever. And we are not. And it's funny that James is, I want you to stop and think about this for a moment this morning, that James has to say something like this to people who live in the first century AD. He's not just talking to the people in the 21st century who have a problem with not wanting to face the fact of their own mortality. He's having to tell people in the first century AD, think about that for a moment this morning, folks. In an ancient world where death rates were higher and life expectancies were lower, in a world in which there were no antibiotics and no vaccines for that matter, people even back then in that world in which death was very much daily in the streets, in which by the time somebody was 10, they'd all seen people die. And yet they still didn't take the end into account in their thinking. How might James rewrite that passage if he were writing to people like us today, who live in Houston, Texas, with the medical center downtown, MD Anderson at our beck and call whenever the diagnosis goes bad, cutting-edge treatments and therapies just around the corner, who live in a world in which, wonder of wonders, a vaccine for a pandemic was produced in less than a year. Isn't that something? What a time to be alive. What might James write to people like us today? If the Lord wills, you'll live and do whatever your plans are. But as it is, you boast in arrogance. Because it's God's will, folks, not ours. That's what matters. Because the truth of the matter is, antibiotics and vaccines aside, the survival rate for this world is still zero. All we're doing is sliding the goalposts back and forth a little bit here and there. We want to live as though death doesn't exist, but even if you live to be 80 or 90, in eternity's perspective, listen, that's still nothing. What's an extra 10 or 15 years in the eyes of forever? And given that you and I will exist for eternity, what happens to us now, what we want to do now, well, it doesn't matter quite the same in the sight of eternity, does it? The real question this morning is, can you live in light of that reality? Can you allow eternity and the reality of eternity to temper our view of death and our view of life? Because your home, your 401k, your retirement pension, your car, your job title, your family, all those things that we base our identity on, that we make the goal of our life, that when we're sitting there and graduating high school, that's what we're thinking about we want to do with our lives and accomplish with our lives. In the end, the only thing that's going to be there is us standing before the throne of God. No matter how you get there or how long you have in this life before you get there, you're still going to get there. And then what? Last couple of minutes this morning, let me make two quick observations about death in the Bible. Number one, death was not original to creation. Actually, that's what I want. Two thoughts closing this morning. Can I let go of this world voluntarily? You see, kind of like Charlton Heston's famous quote in an NRA speech years ago, that the government would take his rifle from his cold, dead hands. We tend to live that way about a lot of things in our lives, and God says, I accept that challenge. Because at the end of the day, I will take everything that's important to you from your cold, dead hands. And so the real message for us right now is, can we learn to let go of this world voluntarily? I think that's part of what God is looking to and asking us to do. Can I let go of what this world offers? Listen, we want our kids to be scholarship students, star athletes, first-tier musicians, but too often with our young people, we're more worried about GPA than G-O-D, and it shows sometimes. When it comes to eternity and even teaching our kids about the reality that even they will die someday, it's trying to get our kids to understand you don't want to stay at home when there's Disney World out there, right? I mean, a 10-year-old can understand this. You offer a 10-year-old a choice, stay home all summer or go to Disney World. What are they going to choose? Disney World. And yet too often we are still the people who, even though we as older adults ought to know better, we read what Scripture says about a new heavens and a new earth where righteousness dwells, where every tear will be wiped away, no sorrow. God is there. Life is there. And yet still, what do? We still keep on holding on to the things that are like staying home all summer. When God has said, listen, there's so much more. There's so much more I have planned. Blessed are the little children who sometimes hold things so much more lightly than their parents do. Can I learn to let go of this world voluntarily? Because eventually you'll be forced to let go of it anyways. And secondly, can you trust God enough to let it go? Can you trust God enough to let it go? Isn't that what it really comes down to, folks? I mean, we know a lot of what we're talking about this morning. There's no new texts on the screen. We've heard all this before. We've read all this before. We know this. And yet, it's still hard, isn't it? Because death is unnatural. It is truly an enemy. There will always be, on one level, a sense of uneasiness there. If Jesus can weep at the tomb of Lazarus, then we can be uncomfortable a little still with the prospect of death. Nothing wrong with that. But can we trust God enough to let go? Can we have enough faith to let go of this age? Because again, the book that we read and base our lives upon is a book consumed with death. And what that book does is it tells the story of one who came from the other side, from eternity itself, from another place, from God himself, to tell us that another world is coming, another existence. But to get there, you have to trust him enough to live this present life in light of what he says about the life to come. And so I ask you this morning, can you do that? Can you trust God enough to let it all go? Because the fact of the matter is, you're going to die. You don't know when, but you're going to die. You might die, young person, in an accidental drowning when you're 17 years old. You might die in a car wreck at 22. You could be a young mother dying in childbirth at 29. You could be struck by lightning at 34 or hit by a car when you're crossing the street at 41. You could even be the lead story on the evening news when you're murdered at 45. Perhaps a plane crash at 47, a heart attack at 53, cancer at 59. Maybe it'll be just something completely random. You're just walking down the road and a stray golf ball from the driving range hits you in the head just right. And that's it. Of course, it could be what we call natural causes at 92. But make no mistake about it, you will die. It's inevitable. It's unavoidable. It's in Genesis 3. And even our happy phrase like natural causes just serves to underscore the fact that death comes eventually, naturally, to everyone. Let that sink in. For most of human history, life was short and it was hard and then you died. That's just the way it was. And everybody knew it and everybody accepted it. It was an unacceptable fact of life for everyone, and everyone from children to adults understood and even saw it firsthand. Death was not a video game where you reset and respawned every time you died. It was not movie make-believe. It's not a dramatized form of entertainment. It was a reality, and everybody knew it. And so lest we end on that morbid note this morning, let me give you three quick passages that you can scribble down and that you can use to turn this rather morbid moment that we've been having this morning to something positive, because this is where the good news of Jesus Christ comes in. Because the fact of the matter is, as Hebrews 9 and verse 27 summarizes, here's passage number one. That it's appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment. There it is. It's that simple. And every day of our lives, we keep that before our lives, because one way or another, we're going to face God in judgment. That's point number one. Point number two is this, though. That most of us would rather find some way to deny, to avoid, to not think about that. We'd rather not have sermons like this morning. We are sometimes very much like Felix, who, when he heard the Apostle Paul talk about the faith in Jesus Christ, which means he talked to him about righteousness and he talked about self-control, but also just as much talking about Jesus as talking about the coming judgment. Felix got alarmed and said, "Go away, and when I find opportunity, I'll summon you." He did not want to talk about it that day, because the truth of the matter is, folks, we never want to talk about it. You know the reason so many people put off making a will? You know the answer already, don't you? Why do so many of us put off making a will? Because we're never going to die, right? Because we don't want to think about it. I remember one of the weirdest experiences I had in my short life thus far was when I was in college. And an elder of the congregation that I worshiped at the time also worked as a librarian, kind of emeritus. He was semi-retired. Worked as a librarian in the school library. And one day, I was in the library minding my own youthful business, young and invincible, man, never going to die, and just enjoying my college years. And I was sitting in the library studying, because that's how I enjoyed my college years. And he comes up to me. He had his attorney with him, and he says, "Hey, can I borrow you for a minute?" And I said, "Sure." And what he asked me to do that day was serve as one of the witnesses. He had been redoing his will. And his attorney had come to meet him where he worked, and he needed a couple of witnesses as he signed his new will in front of his attorney to witness to that. And so there I was, 20, maybe 21 years old, for the first time in my life having any kind of experience like that, signing as a witness the will of a man who had meant a lot to me in my life, one of the beloved elders of the church. What's interesting is he's gone now. And I've often wondered after I heard he passed away, I was no longer living in that city anymore when he passed away. When I got news, I often wondered and thought about when he passed, was the version of the will that was read upon his passing the one that I signed? We'd rather do what Felix does, folks. We'd rather push it off. We'd rather put it out of our minds. We'd rather not get that will written. But here's the third and final verse this morning. And it's back in the book of Hebrews. And it's Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14. Because this is truly one version, one way of getting at why the gospel of Jesus Christ truly is good news. Because what the Hebrew writer reminds us is his way of summarizing the gospel message. Therefore, since the children, you and I, human beings, share in flesh and blood, he himself, this is Jesus now, he himself likewise partook of the same. This is why God became flesh and dwelt among us. This is why he became human. This is why he came down from heaven. He took on flesh because that's what we are. So that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is the devil, because it's the devil who tempts us into sin and thus kills us. So that through his own death he'd go first, as it were, to break Satan and sin and the power of death, render him powerless, and thus, verse 15, might free those, us, who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. You see that line this morning? You understand what it's really all about. Look, you don't deal with death by avoiding the subject. That's not biblical. But what you do is you look death square in the eye and you say, "I'm not afraid of you anymore. You make me uncomfortable. You're that creepy uncle or relative at the holiday gathering or the family reunion. I'm not comfortable around you. You're an enemy still. But I'm not afraid of you anymore. Because I serve a Savior who has beaten you. You took your best shot at him, and on the third day, God, through the Spirit, raised him from the dead. And because I am one of his people, I will not live my life enslaved to the fear of you any longer." Because you know, folks, the fact of the matter is it's one of the most basic points the Bible's trying to make. You can summarize the Bible's message to us in this way. You can only really begin to live when you accept that you are going to die. And when you accept why you're going to die, because of sin. And then you come to God through Jesus to deal with your sin and thus overcome death. And yeah, it's not pleasant any more than going to the doctor is pleasant, getting poked and prodded and stuck and occasionally operated on. It's not pleasant, but you're not afraid of it because you know it's not the last word. It's not the final straw. It is simply the doorway to a greater and fuller life than what we have yet known. And so thanks be to God for the fact that Jesus partook of flesh and blood and overcame death for each and every one of us. If you're here this morning and you are afraid of death because you are not right with God through Jesus, we want to fix that for you this morning. We want to help you fix that by obeying the gospel of Jesus Christ. If you're ready to confess with your mouth who he is, the only begotten Son of God, you're repenting of your sins and place in the world, we'll baptize for forgiveness of your sins this morning, and you can be released from the slavery that is the fear of death. Maybe here this morning you're a child of God already, and there's something that's weighing you down, some sin, some bad habit that's developed, something we can help you with in some way spiritually. Maybe you just need encouragement and uplift. Maybe you need to be reminded that we're all in this together. And you just need to know that your brethren know that you're depressed, you're tired, you're exhausted, you're scared. And you'd like for us to pray with you and for you about that, we'd be happy to do that too. Whatever spiritual need you have that we can help you with in any way this morning, why don't you talk to us right now while we stand and while we sing.